You're listening to The Civil War in the Western Rivers. I'm Todd Hatton. The American Civil War began in the dawn hours of April 12, 1861, when rebel cannons opened fire on Fort Sumter, South Carolina. Six weeks later, Kentucky's pro-Southern governor, Bryan McGoffin, and the largely pro-Union legislature declared their neutrality and warned both sides to keep out.
I solemnly forbid any movement upon the soil of Kentucky or the occupation of any port, post, or place whatever within the lawful boundary and jurisdiction of this state by any of the forces under the orders of the Union or Confederacy for any purpose whatever, until authorized by invitation or permission of the legislative and executive authorities of this state previously granted. Governor Beriah McGoffin.
Neither President Lincoln nor his counterpart, Confederate President and Todd County native Jefferson Davis, were happy about Kentucky neutrality, but it would have to do. Oddly enough, Western Kentuckians responded by preparing for a fight. Paducah lawyer and future Confederate Colonel Albert Thompson even wrote to the Confederate Secretary of War begging for weapons to defend the purchase. Thompson's fellow Paducan Lloyd Tillman raised a regiment of McCracken and Marshall County men and led them south to Confederate Camp Boone in Montgomery County, Tennessee. Purchase politicians weren't standing idle either. In late May, with Kentucky neutral and Tennessee still yet to secede, President Lincoln received this alarming report.
A very delicate question is arising as to Western Kentucky, that portion west of the Tennessee River. Lieutenant William Nelson will explain to you that a convention is now being held at Mayfield which may declare the Jackson position separate from Kentucky, and that this will be followed by an advance of Tennessee troops upon Columbus and Paducah. Major General George B. McClellan, May 30, 1861.
But the plan was short-circuited when Tennessee left the Union. The Kentucky-Tennessee state line became the Confederacy's northern boundary, but it wasn't a natural border like the Ohio River, and the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers pierced it in two places, providing invasion routes deep into the South. According to U.S. Army Combat Studies Institute senior historian Kendall Gott, this meant problems for the rebel commander in the West, General Albert Sidney Johnston.
Being able to shift those forces, whether it's from Columbus or Bowling Green or elsewhere, the Confederate leadership really had to come up with that and then overcome transportation limitations. Three steamboats on the Cumberland, six, seven, eight on the Tennessee, and then the railroads with the different gauges and just not really moving in the directions you need. You had to come up with some plan to get a mobile defense in this western theater because the rivers weren't going to help you. In fact, they were going to hurt you badly, being a high-speed avenue of approach into your sector.
The rebels couldn't occupy the obvious positions in Kentucky, Columbus, Paducah, and Smithland, so Tennessee Governor Isham Harris ordered engineers to scout out locations for two forts, Henry on the Tennessee and Donelson on the Cumberland. Fort Donelson was built on the bluffs downstream of Dover. Fort Donelson National Battlefield Park historian Jim Jobe says Donelson's opposite number, Fort Henry, was truly opposite in at least one regard.
For some reason, they selected a site that was in the floodplain. I can't explain that. It didn't make sense to me. And so Fort Henry was built in a very, very poor location. Captain Jesse Taylor was sent in there as a artillery officer to supervise mounting of the heavy guns at Henry. And when he got there, it was obvious, yeah. He looked up on the riverbank and started writing reports back. There's high water marks on the riverbank above this fort. He sent another report back. I've interviewed longtime residents of this area, and they tell me this fort's going underwater with the spring rise. But he was a captain. He was told to shut up and mount the guns. The generals had made their decision.
In fairness, Johnston and his subordinate General Leonidas Polk may have been preoccupied. By mid-1861, Johnston was busy organizing defenses. Polk was worried about John C. Fremont. Both the Confederacy and the Union understood Western Kentucky's highly strategic position, and both wanted to get there first. In late August, Major General John C. Fremont, head of the U.S. Army's Department of the West, decided to take the initiative. Neutrality be damned.
Brigadier General U.S. Grant, it is intended to occupy Columbus, Kentucky as soon as possible. You will, therefore, upon assuming the command at Cape Girardeau, take command of the combined forward movement. Major General John C. Fremont, August 28, 1861.
Polk got wind of Fremont's intentions and immediately dispatched a letter to Governor Beriah Magoffin.
I think it is of the greatest consequence to the Southern cause in Kentucky and elsewhere that I should be ahead of the enemy in occupying Columbus and Paducah. General Leonidas Polk, September 1st, 1861.
And 2 days later, Polk would get ahead of Grant's troops, at least to Columbus. Paducah would be different.
Arrived at Paducah at 8:30 this morning, found numerous secession flags flying over the city, and the citizens, in anticipation of the approach of the rebel army, which was reliably reported at 3,800 strong and 16 miles distant. As we neared the city, Brigadier General Tillman and staff of the rebel army and a recruiting major with a company raised in Paducah left the city by railroad. I landed the troops and took possession of the city without firing a shot. Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant, September 6, 1861.
Grant's message to the citizens of Paducah struck a very conciliary tone, considering the city's demonstrated Southern sentiment.
I have come among you not as an enemy, but as your friend and fellow citizen, not to injure or annoy you, but to respect the rights and defend and enforce the rights of all loyal citizens. You can pursue your usual avocations without fear or hindrance. The strong arm of the government is here to protect its friends and to punish only its enemies.
Grant's occupation of Paducah forever deprived the Confederates of western Kentucky. It was also a foot in the door, setting the stage for the West's first major campaign. In November 1861, command of the Union Department of the West passed from John C. Fremont to Major General Henry Wager Halleck, nicknamed Old Brains. Whether it was because of his intellect or his intellectual snobbery depended on who you asked. Either way, Halleck understood the purchase's strategic importance. At his headquarters in late 1861, he demonstrated it for two of his staff officers.
General Halleck had a map on his table with a large pencil in his hand and asked, "Where is the rebel line?" General Cullum drew the pencil through Bowling Green, Forts Donelson and Henry, and Columbus, Kentucky. "There is their line," said Halleck. "Now, where is the proper place to break it?" And either Cullum or I said, "Naturally, the center." Halleck drew a line perpendicular to the other near its middle, and it coincided nearly with the general course of the Tennessee River. And he said, "That's the true line of operation." William Tecumseh Sherman.
Kendall Gott says hearing that would have shocked Confederate General Johnston.
He was focused like a laser beam on Bowling Green, and then secondary is the Mississippi. And that's a lot because Polk is out there. And just a casual look at the map, yeah, you can hold Bowling Green, but if they come up to Tennessee or Cumberland, the Union forces are now in your rear and about to cut you off. And putting a tiny little fort with 12 guns out there to defend the Cumberland and the Tennessee, you're building in a swamp, you know, come on.
But Johnston also had more mathematical difficulties.
The manpower of the Confederacy, particularly in the West, was just never going to match man for man the Union resources out there. So what the Confederacy had to do was rely greatly on these river forts to be key strong points to hold, but they never really had enough men to hold them. The Confederate leadership, in my opinion, should have come up with a far better way to deal with their defense than they ended up doing. For instance, they had a whole bunch of guys over in Columbus holding the line out there for an attack that never materialized because everything was happening off to the east.
Jim Jobe says Johnston may not have had much choice.
I hate to be too critical because I think they gave him an impossible job. They gave him this vast territory to watch and nowhere near the resources to do it. And he had two armies to worry about. And all these rivers, which were pre-war, had been such a great asset. I mean, they provided transportation, but all of a sudden, they gave the Union Army all sorts of places to invade on. And he had more rivers to watch than he had people to do, and he just couldn't watch everything.
One thing Johnston should have watched was the buildup of U.S. troops at Paducah and the increasing number of gunboats heading toward the Tennessee River. General Halleck's Old Brains had at last developed a unique plan to break the Confederate line. At 9 a.m., February 6, 1862, Grant and two divisions of 20,000 men landed on both banks of the Tennessee River north of Fort Henry. One division moved down the east shore to cut Henry off from Fort Donelson. The other moved on the incomplete, lightly manned Fort Hyman, positioned on the opposite Kentucky bluffs to cover the low-lying Henry. Seven Navy gunboats also steamed upriver to shell the position. It was over in 2 hours. Heavy spring rains and the rising river won the battle even before the first shot. With water rushing over his parapets, U.S. gunboats pounding away, one working cannon, and Union troops bearing down on him and already in Fort Hyman, Rebel Commander Lloyd Tillman surrendered himself, one gun crew, and Fort Henry at 11 a.m. The rest of his 2,500 men escaped to Fort Donelson. With Henry in hand, Grant wired General Halleck that he would immediately attack Donelson. Hearing no reply, Grant presumed Halleck's approval, but Halleck hadn't received any of Grant's messages, and he assumed Grant would wait 3 weeks to regroup. The disconnect was due to a rebel-sympathizing telegraph operator in Paducah who simply threw Grant's daily reports into the trash. No matter what, instead of 3 weeks, Grant would only wait 6 days.
I left Fort Henry on the 12th instant with a force of about 15,000 men divided into two divisions. 6 regiments were sent by water the day before. The troops made the march in good order, the head of the column arriving within 2 miles of the fort at 12 o'clock. The fortifications were from this point approached and surrounded. The following day, owing to the non-arrival of the gunboats and the reinforcements sent by water, no attack was made. But the investment was extended on the flanks of the enemy and drawn closer to his works. Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant.
Fort Donelson historian Jim Job takes up the story.
Gunboats start arriving here on the 12th. And one gunboat at long range comes around on the 12th and again on the 13th and fires several rounds at long range. And the Union Army's arriving about that time, too. Grant wanted to get the infantry in place here to prevent an escape and then let the gunboats attack just like they had to Henry. And he's hoping that the gunboats will attack, control the river just like they did to Henry. He controls the river then with the gunboats, and he has them surrounded on the land side. Then he'll just wait for a surrender. He won't really have to attack with his infantry. But unlike Henry, his face is a much stronger position here, and the gunboats were defeated.
In the first attack, Commander Henry Walk's gunboat Carondelet drew heavy fire. One shell pierced the iron armor and bounced around inside, wounding several sailors before shooting out and dropping into the water, still hissing. By the 14th, all the players were in place. Grant had encircled both Fort Donelson and the town of Dover. He then conferred with the commander of the gunboat fleet, Flag Officer Andrew Foote.
And he's urging Foote to attack. And on the afternoon of February the 14th, he does. All the Confederates have heard these stories about these monster boats that had captured Fort Henry. You know they're coming. And sure enough, around that bend, here comes the bow of one of those boats, and then two, and then three, and then four of those ironclad gunboats. Fort Henry is the first use of these ironclad gunboats that I can find in this country. So neither side knew what they're really capable of doing. They come around that bend of the river, which is a mile and a half away or so, form in battle line, and start approaching the fort.
Having little else to do that day, Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest watched the spectacle from the bluffs. Turning to an aide, Forrest gave the former minister a piece of his mind.
Parson, for God's sake, pray. Ain't nothing but God Almighty can save that fort.
Before long, the South opens fire, because the South has 2 cannons that'll reach that range. And that's not enough to stop them. They keep pushing. And they're going to try the same tactic that they used at Henry, which was pull up as close as you could and blow it off the map. The gunboats continue to press to about 350, 400 yards. They're hoping the iron covering is going to protect them. But at that close range, they're really taking a pounding. And now they're so close, they're shooting uphill, and it made aiming more difficult. There's shots landing in Dover. But the Confederate aim got really good.
As the rest of the rebel guns opened fire, a round hit the pilot house of Foote's flagship, damaging the wheel, wounding Foote, and killing the pilot. His gunboat disabled, Foote allowed the current to take his vessel out of harm's way. Similar damage to 2 other ironclads sent them back down the river as well. That left Commander Walk and the Carondelet. Its steering was also damaged, but instead of drifting downriver to safety, it got caught on the opposite bank, in range of Donelson's guns.
And once it's by itself, apparently every Confederate cannon trains on it. And it really starts ringing her ears inside that boat. To make matters worse, it's got large iron cannons on it as well. These large iron guns sometimes explode. One of the Confederate guns at Henry blew up. The tube just can't take it anymore, and the tube explodes. Well, that's bad on the crew. One of those iron guns inside that boat blew up.
Before the decks were well sanded, there was so much blood on them that our men could not work the guns without slipping. Commander Henry Walk.
Mercifully, the Carondelet eventually falls back down the river out of range. In all, the fight between the water batteries and the gunboats resulted in 54 U.S. sailors dead, more than half of that number on the Carondelet alone.
So the South here had defeated those dreaded ironclad gunboats, and these Confederate cannoneers were very afraid when they started coming up here. And so all of a sudden they're falling back. So they start cheering and yelling and celebrating. And it was contagious. The fort starts cheering and celebrating, and that catches on with all the Confederates in the outside. So it is said that the hills and hollows surrounding Dover echoed with Confederate shouts of victory. It was a little premature because they're still surrounded by 27,000 forces.
The three rebel brigadier generals in charge of Fort Donelson certainly thought so. Since Fort Henry, command had passed to Kentuckian Simon Bolivar Buckner, Tennessean Gideon Pillow, and Virginian John Floyd. Floyd, being senior, was in overall command. The problem was Buckner and Pillow had hated each other since the Mexican War, and Floyd tended to make decisions based on whoever he'd talked to last. They did agree on one thing. They needed to leave. Thinking their 14,000 troops faced 40,000 Federals, far more than there actually were, they decided to pull out and join up with General Johnston in Nashville. To get there, they had to clear a path to the Charlotte Road, running east out of Dover. Throughout the 14th, the Confederates moved to their left, stripping their right flank down to 450 Tennesseans armed with shotguns. This one regiment faced the entire 2nd Division of the Union Army of the Tennessee. At 6 o'clock the next morning, six rebel brigades, along with 4th's cavalry, charged out of their works and smashed into the U.S. 1st Division southeast of Dover, driving them back almost a mile. Of the 1st Division's four brigades, two scattered, one ran, and a fourth was crushed as it came forward. By 1 p.m., the road to Nashville was open. Just then, General Pillow ordered the Confederates back to their trenches. Buckner objected, so the two took their dispute to Floyd, who sided with Pillow and ordered a retreat. Meanwhile, Grant was on the St. Louis, urging a diversionary attack on the shore batteries. But hearing the distant guns, Grant dropped the matter and raced back to the line as fast as the muddy ground allowed. When he arrived, he saw men just standing around.
The soldiers had their muskets but no ammunition, while there were tons of it close at hand. I turned to Colonel Webster of my staff and said, "Some of our men are pretty badly demoralized, but our enemy must be more so, for he's attempted to force his way out but has fallen back. The one that attacks first now will be victorious, and the enemy will have to be in a hurry to get ahead of me." I determined to make the assault at once on our left and called out to the man, "Fill your cartridge boxes quickly and get into line. The enemy is trying to escape, and he must not be permitted to do so." This acted like a charm. The men only wanted someone to give them command. Ulysses S. Grant.
Quickly and coolly, Grant did the math. If the rebels were strong at this one spot, they had to be weak somewhere else. And he happened to have a dependable commander at that somewhere else, his old West Point professor, Charles Smith.
We rode rapidly to Smith's quarters. I explained the situation to him and directed him to charge the enemy's works in his front with his whole division, saying that he would find nothing more but a very thin line to contend with. The general was off, going in advance himself. The outer line was passed, and the night of the 15th, General Smith, with much of his division, bivouacked within the lines of the enemy. There was now no doubt that the Confederates must surrender or be captured the next day.
Confederate Generals Floyd, Pillow, and Buckner agreed.
About 12 o'clock at night, I was called in council with the generals, who had under discussion the surrender of the fort. They supposed the enemy had returned to the positions they had occupied the day before. I returned to my quarters and sent out two men who, going by a road up the bank of the river, returned without seeing any of the enemy, only fires which I believed to be old campfires, and so stated to the generals the wind, being very high, had fanned them to a blaze. Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest.
But the generals were unconvinced. Floyd said he would not be captured. He feared arrest over pre-war charges he had transferred arms to the South while Secretary of War. Pillow also stated he wouldn't be taken. In the end, Floyd transferred command to Pillow. Pillow, in turn, gave it to Buckner, and Buckner sent for a courier. Forrest had no intention of going quietly, at least into captivity.
I asked if they were going to surrender the command. General Buckner remarked that they were. I then stated that I had not come out for the purpose of surrendering my command and would not do it, that I intended to go out if I saved but one man.
Buckner told Forrest he could leave if he got out before the surrender became official. Forrest did, with about 500 men. On the morning of February 16th, Buckner wrote to Grant, "Sir, in consideration of all the circumstances, I propose the appointment of commissioners to agree upon terms of capitulation of the forces and post under my command, and in that view suggest an armistice until 12 o'clock today.
Sir, no terms except unconditional and immediate surrender can be accepted. I propose to move immediately upon your works. U.S. Grant, Brigadier General Commanding.
Believing he had no choice, Buckner agreed to surrender the fort and his troops. Not all the Confederates, however, were ready to give up. Some slipped past their guards, but most were shipped off to prisoner of war camps in the North. News of Donelson sparked bell ringing and celebrations in the North. In the South, it brought criticism and blame.
The enemy could not have reinvested their former position without traveling a considerable distance and camped upon the dead and dying, as there had been a great slaughter upon that portion of the field. And I am clearly of the opinion that 2/3 of our army could have marched, should have gained a glorious victory, as our troops were in the fine spirits, believing we had whipped them. Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest.
U.S. Army historian Kendall Gott says that by later Civil War standards, Fort Donelson was a small battle, only around 41,000 Union and Confederates involved. But it was a loss from which the Confederacy would never recover.
This is where things started falling apart for the South, particularly in the West. A number of different things could have happened to go either way, but in my opinion, this is really where the door gets kicked in, and after this point, the South is in a position of trying to recover or at least hold back this slow but certain juggernaut from the Union forces that are going to just sweep through the Western Confederacy and eventually go all the way to Savannah and up into the Carolinas.
After Fort Donelson, Brigadier General Ulysses S. Grant became Major General Unconditional Surrender Grant. Along with Paducah, Donelson would be Grant's first steps toward Appomattox Courthouse.